we became so disenchanted with the whole, like, social, like, just the whole society of consumerism and having so much stuff in our house. And so we said, you know what? It's not worth it. We're just going to quit. We're going to, like, take whatever we have. We gave everything away. We gave it all away. Like, everything in our house. Beds, you know, cat, everything. Just, we're like, we're done. And we were actually up in Montana visiting some family. We were about an hour away from catching our flight back home. And we were driving to the airport. And we stopped at this place called Brett's RV. And we, no kidding, bought an RV. We missed our flight. And we ended up driving home in the RV, parking this 32-foot RV in front of our house, and then proceeding to, like, sort of get it ready for our exit from society.
So, welcome to another episode of Gone Workabout, interesting stories from around the world. And I'm here with Adam of Give Kefir. Welcome.
Ah, thank you.
So we're actually sitting right now in your, what should I call it, in your kitchen?
You could call it our brew kitchen.
Your brew kitchen.
Our brewing kitchen, yeah.
And what's around us? Just describe it to people.
So this is the evolution of our home kitchen, which used to be, which is now a fermentation kitchen. So we have bottles, 2 gallon, well, we have 2 gallon jugs full of cultures, kefir culture, June culture, kombucha culture. And they're basically going through a first ferment right here around us now. And then these, once they're ready, will go into smaller bottles where we can seal them up tighter, and then they'll go through a second fermentation. So we have racks of bottles over here. And then once they're done with the second fermentation, we will then put them into the fridge to slow down the fermentation process and chill them. Over here, you know, we have glasses for serving, the dried fruits like the ginger, cinnamon, ginger, lemon, lime, lemongrass. We have hibiscus roselle and ginseng and a few other things. So all of our ingredients are over here.
A lot of things that you don't we get them when we go to a Thai restaurant in England or Australia or in the States, right? But not things that are commonly local. And I like the fact that you guys are using a lot of ingredients that are local.
So that is partially because that's what we prefer, and also because it's expensive to ship things into Cambodia.
Yeah.
So it's way simpler for us to find locally sourced ingredients. Because our idea is that we want to make the process as simple as possible.
Cool.
Because we may eventually, hopefully, you know, be traveling.
Mm-hmm.
And we want our staff that we're training up right now to be able to take over.
Sure.
And know where to get these things or, you know, make these ingredients themselves.
Cool. So I feel like now is a good time for us to define what kefir, kombucha, okay, and June are. Do you want to give us a bit of an overview for people that maybe have seen sauerkraut on a plate,
mm-hmm,
and maybe heard about kefir but don't really know what it is?
Okay, sure. So we could start with kombucha.
Yeah.
And the June. Well, actually, and the kefir. They're all made with what is called a SCOBY, which is a symbiotic culture of bacteria and yeast. The acronym SCOBY, S-C-O-B-Y. And that is basically living organisms, bacteria, different strains of bacteria, living with different strains of yeasts. And so the bacteria basically will eat the sugars and the minerals that we put, that we feed to them through a liquid, like for the kombucha, it's a black tea, a sweet black tea.
Okay.
That we use sugar to sweeten. With the June, we feed the bacteria and yeast a green tea, which is sweetened with honey. And for the kefir, we're feeding them like a mineralized water and sugar.
And there's different types of kefir brewing, isn't there? Like I've come across milk, coconut, and water.
Right.
I think you might be the first group that I've seen doing water kefir.
Right. We started, we learned about water kefir in Maryland near when I was working in D.C. last year. And we had been big fans of kombucha. We'd been all over the United States. And if we see a new brand of kombucha on the shelves, we're drinking it.
Yeah.
And it's really big in the States. So there's always new types of kombucha to try. So we were trying it everywhere. And then I don't know how, I think just in researching how to make kombucha. And I was also making some milk kefir when we lived in Hawaii, which was right before Maryland. We have a home out there actually. Anyways, I learned about the water kefir. And when we got to Maryland, I ordered some from a lady down in Florida and we got it and we started making it and it was delicious. And I was like, how come nobody is making this anywhere, commercially at least, because I've never come across it.
I think you're right. I think that's the way that I've seen it in New Zealand and then in Australia and also in England, is that kefir, milk kefir has started to come in, but kombucha's been around for a few years as kind of like a hippie ginger bean, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we found the water kefir grains. Some people call them grains. They're actually the SCOBY again, or the culture, which is the bacteria and the yeast that have formed this symbiotic relationship. So the bacteria will eat the sugar that we put in the water and the minerals that are in the sugar, because we use like an unrefined organic cane sugar.
Right.
So they'll pull everything out of there they want, and they'll turn it into fructose and sucrose. They'll do that conversion, and then the yeast picks it up. And they'll eat the fructose and the sucrose. And they'll eat that, that the bacteria, one of their metabolites, I guess, or their byproduct. The yeast picks that up, eats it, and then puts off like different ester acids, different CO2 and alcohol. And anyways, through this process of bacteria eating and putting off byproducts, feeding the yeast eating, putting off byproducts, you end up with this liquid that is just full of organic acids and antioxidants and, you know, micronutrients and, you know, bioavailable minerals and vitamins that are pretty delicious.
I mean, it's just
and
good
really
for
good for your gut.
Yeah.
And
do you want to talk about that a bit? Because I think that's the reason that I've seen, say, colleagues and in England, say a Brazilian guy, he had some really nasty sort of anxiety moments and his health just really wasn't good. And they thought he had irritable bowel syndrome. And I said, mate, just get some of this milk kefir. This particular one is just one off the shelf and it's just cherry flavored. You get it in the supermarket. Just have one of those a day and see if that helps.
Mm-hmm.
And he obviously stopped drinking coffee, started eating healthier at the same time.
Right.
But he said that the kefir really settled his stomach and he felt like, in his very Brazilian way, things were moving again.
Right, right, right.
So do you want to just talk about the digestive element and how you've seen that benefiting folks?
So I think the thing that, you know, about that is probably the most beneficial is that these bacteria and yeasts are beneficial. So they work with our bodies. You know, it's not like you're introducing some foreign bacteria. You're actually giving your body and your gut the bacteria and yeast that it wants in order to actually digest your food. And so these things live in there. And, you know, we are more bacteria as organisms than we are human cells. You know, whatever a human cell is. So I've even heard people say, you know, that we're more, since we are billions of, you know, trillions of bacteria organisms living, that we're actually, maybe we are actually supporting them.
Yeah.
Because they outnumber us, you know.
Like a coral reef or something
right.
like that.
So we are living with them.
Yes.
They're not like something you put in and, okay, it's nice to have, but if I don't have it, it's okay. No, we're living with them. It's a symbiotic relationship. So we need them. And through, like, I don't know if you call it a Western diet or just a processed food diet, throw in antibiotics, you know, that are in everything these days, alcohol,
coffee.
Yeah. You know, all these things that just sort of wear on your body over time and overstress it. You know, those bacteria and yeast that live inside of you that are supporting you from the inside just get worn down. I mean, and their populations get reduced. And so then you eat, you know, some food and there's not enough of them, or they're just working sluggishly. And so you eat that Big Mac, or I don't know what, anything.
Big steak.
Or yeah. Even the vegetables you eat, you know, if you don't have the right population, or a, not the right population, but a thriving population of bacteria in your body, then your body has to work harder to try to break that stuff down and make it available to, you know, go through your gut lining and into your blood and into your body. You know, so it's actually useful for you. So this goes in there. It sort of replenishes the whole population of bacteria inside your gut. And, you know, the nice thing about drinking it in this form with the liquid, the metabolite solution, is it is a prebiotic too. So the bacteria go in and now they actually have brought their lunch with them. So they can set up residence in an unhealthy gut even. And they bring, you know, their sugars and minerals and everything with them. And they can, like, actually set up shop inside of you.
Yeah.
And continue to grow. So you could have, you know, there is one glass of this is beneficial to you.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to help you for the rest of your life until you, you know, take a big shot of antibiotics again.
Sure.
And deplete it. But,
or you go out and have a few beers because we kind of... And I think with a lot of these things, I like what the Dalai Lama says about the middle way. And I don't know if he meant that for me to apply that to going out and having a few beers once a week or something like that. But I tell you what, if I come home after that and have some kefir or some kombucha, or maybe have a bottle of that the next morning, the hangover is much less. And as I've sort of learned over time, the alcohol's gone in and leached out a lot of the good things in my gut and and from my body, right? And having some kefir go in or some kombucha has replenished it, like you say.
Well, yeah, and the bacteria, because the yeast produces alcohol and CO2, and the bacteria can actually consume that alcohol and then feed it back to the yeast as sucrose and fructose. And
alcohol is fuel.
Is fuel. So, you know, those two, you know, much like the bacteria and the yeast in your body being symbiotic with us, the bacteria and yeast are symbiotic with one another, so they keep feeding one another and go round and round. And no one, it's interesting, no one created kombucha or kefir. You know, if you wanted one, you couldn't make it today. You'd have to be given one by somebody else.
In terms of the starter culture?
In terms of the culture. You know, there's theories about where it originated from, with the water kefir grains or water kefir culture. It's also called tibicos.
Tibicos.
T-I-B-I-C-O-S. They say it actually grows naturally on a cactus. It'll actually form like a, I forget the, which cactus exactly, but I want to say it's from like Central America, Mexico.
Everything comes back to Mexico, right?
Yeah.
Chocolate, coffee, cactus, avocado.
So, yeah. Right. It was just the right environment for those, you know, bacteria and yeast in the air maybe formed and started, had the right food. And,
so what have I got here in front of me? What is this one?
So this one you're looking at is the kombucha.
Okay.
And I think that one is probably in our second ferment, we call it F2.
Okay.
The first ferment is with the actual culture in it.
Right.
And that's where the bacteria and yeast are like working to extract all the sugars and the minerals out of the black tea.
Yep. And it looks, to those that have not seen it before, like I'm looking at a small homebrew beer kit that has kind of almost like a mushroom-shaped culture inside it.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. It's like about 1 inch. Here's one here, actually, right behind me, or a bunch of them.
Yeah.
You know, maybe a 1 inch sort of gelatinous mass.
Yeah.
Floating at the top of this 2 gallon jug full of black sweet tea.
Right. And so it's kombucha because it's black tea. It's June because it's green tea.
It's June because it's a different culture.
Okay.
And so then the food source for June is honey. Whereas the food source for the kombucha culture is sugar.
I see.
Like a cane sugar.
Right. And I haven't come across June before we met. So
June is one of those sort of like it is a relative of kombucha.
Right.
But adjusted to using honey as a the food source instead of sugar.
Which is attractive in many ways.
It is nice. It gives it a different flavor profile. You know, honey is like naturally antibacterial.
Yeah.
So if you were to throw a bunch of honey in here with the kombucha culture, it would probably just kill the SCOBY.
Yeah, because it wouldn't have the food that it wanted.
Yeah, and it's honey is like a natural antibiotic.
Of course it is.
So, and these are bacteria, so it would kill them.
Does that mean that June has different antibacterial or micronutrient properties?
I would say it definitely has a different, the end result definitely has different properties, you know. But I also think because it has a different set of different strains of bacteria.
Right.
Growing in this SCOBY.
And when I just want to share this with people too, that when I first came across kefir, it was actually a flatmate's friend talking in the kitchen in Melbourne about making water kefir. And I was like, that's so hippy-dippy. And sure. I say this as someone who grew up barefoot, was homeschooled in New Zealand, out of reach of power lines with a generator and lived off stream water. Whose parents are educated hippies.
Uh-huh.
And I thought that's a bit hippy-dippy, yeah. Right? But I think with any of these things, if you break it down, it looks like Dad's homebrew kit.
Sure.
Fermentation is how we make beer. I get it.
Sure.
You know, I know that things are fermenting in my stomach because I burp, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we all intuitively know that acidic, vinegary type things are actually really good. We've come across apple cider vinegar. We put vinegar into a lot of our food. We put a lot of lemon and lime into things. We know that honey is good for us. And we all eat mushrooms. And I know it's a slightly different makeup.
Mm-hmm, sure.
But if I look at what looks to me like a big water mushroom, if that's producing a vinegar that's good for my digestion, then I'm totally up for it.
Yeah.
And people, this stuff's really booming, particularly in places like the States and call it the West.
Yeah. Yeah. My first introduction to kombucha was when I was a kid, actually.
A long time ago.
Are you saying I'm old?
Well, I think you're younger than me, so.
I'm 44 now. And that's as old as I've ever been.
So. Right.
But when I was a kid, I was, my mom was given one, a SCOBY from a neighbor. And we grew up in a small town called Frenchtown, Montana. It was about 3,000 people. And it was about half an hour outside of this bigger town called Missoula, Montana. But
I did not know that. You know, the whole Creole, is that Creole? Was it Creole influence in that area? Or
I would not say so. I mean,
further north.
In Montana?
Where is Montana? Is it the north of the States?
It's northwest.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's closer to perhaps where the French came into Canada?
Yeah, some French influence maybe there for sure. I mean, French town. But, you know, and there were some older families there. But anyways, we moved there in 1977, maybe.
Okay.
I think I was 2 or 3 years old. Farmland, you know, I grew up changing irrigation pipes in for the farmers around before school. I'd have to get up early and go over to the farmer's fields and move irrigation pipes, you know, at 5 a.m. and then come back home and change and get to school. And we lived about a quarter mile from the elementary school. So once in a while, I would actually my dad would have to go to work at the mill where they made paper, and I would take the truck and drive to school, like 6th grade, 7th grade, which is unheard of.
How old is 7th grade?
Seventh grade. I mean, what are you, like 12 or something at that point?
Right. It's a proper rural. No,
it was rural, right?
It's Marlborough Man country, right?
And one of the teachers in there would come out and be like, "Hey, I noticed your dad's truck was out there. I didn't see your dad." Like, he goes, "Why don't you just take it home and walk back?" Okay. So wow. Drive it home, walk home, or walk back to school. But anyway, so that's my mom somehow came across this horrendous looking kombucha culture. You know, it's this weird gelatinous mass with little strings of what I now know are yeast hanging off of it. And she started making a kombucha. And we, you know, she did that for a little while, a few months, I think, before we all revolted. And it just wasn't worth it anymore for her to like try to, because you have to keep it alive. You know, you can't stick it in the cupboard or.
Yeah, my mom's going to laugh if she listens to this because she's had the same experience with milk kefir.
Right? Oh, sure.
Slipping it into things so they won't notice.
Right? And now it's funny because here I am brewing it. Although, you know, now I understand it and we can do with that second fermentation process, you can really make this stuff delicious.
So how would it taste after that first, what is it, 48 hours?
Well, it depends on variables.
Right.
How much you feed it, the temperature is a big one. So if it's really warm, it'll move faster. You know, the bacteria and yeast are just cruising along. But so ours, we keep it about 26 Celsius in here all the time.
Right.
And it'll run the first ferment 5 days.
Oh, 5 days. Yeah. Okay. So that feels a little bit longer than I used to brew kefir, milk kefir. And what does it taste like after that first 5 days, this kombucha?
So once it starts getting a little sour, you know that it's sort of hitting like this, like a curve, right?
Okay.
And you start getting a little sour, it's going to start getting sour faster and faster. I guess it's more like this, right?
It's basically running out of sugar.
It's running out of food, right? And then so now as it's processing everything, it's more and more sour and less sweet. So we try to catch it where it's actually, you know, it's getting sour, but not so sour that it kind of loses its palatability.
Okay.
Some people might like it more sour, but we find that for the general population, just starting to get sour, you still have enough time in there that the bacteria and the yeast have like matured.
Right.
Because you're getting that sourness, but not so much that it's, you know, you can't drink it.
Okay. So then you take the whole kit and caboodle out and put it into a new barrel. Is that right?
So we'll take the culture out because at that point it's done its job. We'll put it into a new home.
Okay.
Either a new batch of black tea or green tea or mineral water for the kefir. Put it into a new one, or we can put them to sleep. Or put them in like a hotel where they can sort of just hang out. Because we're not selling that much right now. So we put we sort of put them on hold.
Okay.
Quite often.
Yeah. Like putting a turtle in the fridge.
Yeah.
Or in the freezer.
Yeah.
Okay. And so what I'm really interested in what happens in the second ferment, because when I was making milk kefir, I got the grains, I put them into a mason jar. I filled it up with organic milk if I could get it, full fat milk to feed it. And I put a cloth over the top, put it in the cupboard or close to the heater because I wanted it to be that sort of 26 degrees. And then a couple of days later, I've got this stuff that looks pretty nasty. But then you pour it out and it tasted like a kind of an effervescent Greek yogurt.
Mm-hmm.
And it is just amazing for digestion.
Yeah.
But I never did the second ferment. So explain a bit about what you put into, where you put the half-made kombucha for the second ferment and what you add to it.
Okay. So you could certainly drink it just like this. I mean, after the first ferment.
Okay.
And, you know, that would have all the health benefits of kombucha or jun or our water kefir. But we have actually, what we like to do is to take different plants that have, you know, either certain properties that we like spirulina or just flavor profiles that we like. And then we'll take the culture out. So now we just have the liquid. We'll strain it into like another vessel, maybe another 2 gallon jug or maybe into one of our like 1 liter swim top bottles.
Right.
Strain it into there so that there's no culture gelat like mass in there anymore, but it's still filled with billions of basically, you know, bacteria and yeast you just can't see. So they throughout the liquid, and then we will add in the fresh or the dried fruits or the dried herbs at that point, seal it up. And basically at that point, you're kind of like a chemist. You know,
I love how science-y it is.
Right? There's no rule as to how long it's going to take because there's so many variables. You're always tasting. And as we train the staff here, I'm like, just taste it. Just taste it. You know, does it need more of this? Does it need more time? Is it getting so fizzy right now that the bottle's going to explode? You need to get it in the fridge.
And I noticed a little bit up the wall there.
Yeah, the wall here is slightly covered. we've taken to opening the bottles very carefully around here because some of them explode and then someone has to clean off the walls around here.
So what sort of flavors have you got? What sort of plants are you adding in?
Some of our favorites are ginger. We were just buying dried ginger. And then we just decided to start making our own. So one of our staff, actually, Vute, she dries all the ginger for us.
Amazing.
In the sun and does like a beautiful job with it. And then turmeric is another lovely one because you can actually put it in the bottle, seal it up and leave it. And whereas if you put like a chunk of pineapple in there, it's going to keep, there's so much sugar, you know, stuck in that chunk of
and
pineapple.
And Cambodian pineapples are amazingly sweet.
Right. So then it's just like putting in a shot glass of sugar syrup. And so it's going to kick that whole process of bacteria eating, feeding yeast, you know, creating alcohol and CO2. And so you'll get really fizzy to the extent where it's just too much. Right. And the alcohol content will start creeping up on you. So as we're, you pull out a 4-week-old bottle of pineapple water kefir, and my wife can't even drink it because, you know, she gets like a little flushed even with a touch of alcohol.
So it's almost heading in the direction of moonshine.
It's going that way. And my daughter, you know, who's 7, she's like, another cup. And I'm like, are we getting this child drunk right now? Or why does she love this stuff so much?
I think that kids also know what's good for them. They're a lot more intuitive than we are, right?
Sure.
And, okay.
So we keep an eye on it. So that second ferment, like you said, so we're putting a Roselle hibiscus flower is a really nice one. We try to stick, like, lemongrass is another one, and that's sort of a traditional, like you said, Cambodian flavoring and food. So we like to put that in as well.
And when people go into their local health food shop or increasingly just a reasonably well-heeled supermarket or an organic shop and they see kombucha on the shelf,
mm-hmm.
it's gone through that second ferment and that's where they've put the flavor that's in there, right? Like you might get a lemon and lime or a honey and certain type of tea. Is that what we're saying?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. Although there's many ways to do it.
Okay.
You know, we like to use actual like live plant material
right.
to put in there because intuitively, and there's no science that I have behind this, but intuitively, I just, you know, I can almost visualize the bacteria, you know, permeating into that ginger, that turmeric, that lemongrass, and sort of munching down what it is that they want. And, you know, and then that byproduct being like the most whole form of that plant material, that like almost like plant medicine.
Yeah.
So it feels like an infusion to me. Whereas some people will take like sugar, you know, pineapple, they'll make a syrup.
Okay.
And they'll just pour, the syrup in there and then flavor it that way and cap it.
Right.
Which is okay. I mean, maybe it's all still in there, but intuitively, we like to add the whole plant, the whole fruit.
It's like a whole food approach.
Like a whole food approach, right? Right.
Which I think will speak to a lot of people because we all grew up with McDonald's apple pies and learning over time that an apple is close to the orchard as we can get. is easier for the body to recognize and process. Right. And I think people are very much that idea has entered the mainstream. Right. So let's talk a little bit about give kefir.
Mm-hmm.
Why give kefir and why Siem Reap in Cambodia?
I know, such a big question. It really is. So why Cambodia? So I don't know the best way to answer that other than we were living in San Diego, okay. 5 years ago.
Southwest, yeah.
Yeah, and San Diego, California. And I had a well-paying job. I was making, for a U.S. standard, it was pretty well, like $200,000 range a year.
Wow.
And my wife and I decided that over the course of a couple of years, I had that job for about almost a decade. And we became so disenchanted with the whole, just the whole society of consumerism and having so much stuff in our house. We were just felt like we were owned by the things that we owned. And we really became disenchanted to the point where we were feeling pretty miserable. And, even though we would wake up every day, go to Whole Foods, fill up our shopping cart with, organic raspberries and whatever we wanted, and then go around Encinitas, California, and buy whatever we wanted, go home, go out, find some lunch, back home, and then, end up out somewhere for dinner. So we're eating out, three times a day. And then we're back home and we're like, we have everything and we're unhappy. And our, Nala was at that point, 2, 3 years old. And so we said, you know what? It's not worth it. We are just going to quit. We're going to take whatever we have. We gave everything away. We gave it all away. Like everything in our house, beds, cat, everything. Just we're done. And we were actually up in Montana visiting some family. We were about an hour away from catching our flight back home, and we were driving to the airport, and we stopped at this place called Brett's RV, and we, no kidding, bought an RV. We missed our flight, and we ended up driving home in the RV, parking this 32-foot RV in front of our house, and then proceeding to get it ready for our exit from society, right? And so we spent a couple months outfitting it. I quit my job and we got into this RV and we're like, we're just going to drive around. We'll just park in grassy fields. We'll just go wherever we want, whenever we want. It'll be super fantastic. And we did that for almost 7 months. And one of the best times of our lives, also one of the hardest times of our lives, because society is not really things weren't geared for us to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. Couldn't find places to park. It saved us no money at all. The parks and stuff are expensive. The fuel is horrendous that those things, I'm getting 10 miles per gallon, in this RV. You can't drive into town with it.
Yeah.
Because it's so big. So we made some mistakes, but
long story short, right?
We loved it. It was one of our favorite things. And then at the end of that, though, we just wanted some place to settle down again. And fortunately, the job that I had quit, they gave me a consulting position, which worked out really well because instead of being an employee making a few cents on every dollar that I sold, I'm now plus having a salary. I started making 7-10% on everything that I sold, which worked out really well because I was selling things that were worth millions of dollars.
Oh, wow.
And so all of a sudden we got this chunk of money. We got a couple of checks showed up, 100,000, 180,000, 70,000.
Couldn't even imagine that.
And we were okay, let's not ruin this. we're going to go buy a home somewhere and settle down. And so we were looking all over. We flew out to Puerto Rico. There's this island called Vieques. We went down to Nicaragua and then went out to this island called Little Corn Island, because we'd heard there's no cars there. Remember, we're still disenchanted with society at this point. Totally. So you have to fly into Nicaragua, into Managua, then to the coast, Bluefields, I think it is, and something like that. And then you have to fly to on a smaller plane to Big Corn Island. Then you have to get on a small boat and go to Little Corn Island. And we went out there to look at a house that was for sale. And while we were there, we were like, this is beautiful. We love it here, but there's no Whole Foods, right? They weren't growing any food. There was no cars on the island, which was beautiful. But eventually, so we went to look at the house and they were like, well, where are the owners going? And they're like, well, they're moving to Fiji. So we're like, well, maybe Fiji's better. So then we flew to Fiji, right? And we were like, we hated it. We just didn't enjoy it at all. And that's a whole nother story. And then we came back to the States, back to Southern California, and we're like, we've been all over the place. And this is over the course of 6-7 months, you know,
with those places,
with Nala, you know, two-year-old. And we're like, you know what? Forget it. You know, there's no winning this game. We're just going to buy a house right here in San Diego, a place called Fallbrook. And there was a dome home that was like as far from society as we were going to get as buying a dome
home. Kind of an eco house.
And it was beautiful. And we just couldn't commit. Although we had the contract and we'd given them $10,000 in earnest money and the time was running out. It was the night that we had to make a decision or we lose our money or we had to proceed with the sale. Mm-hmm. You know, we had a choice to make. And we were sitting in our house, which has like almost no furniture, by the way, because after the RV, whole 7 months in the RV, we came back. We're like, we're not going to refurnish a home and buy a bunch of
and
stuff again.
Giving everything away, right?
Yeah. We're giving everything away. So we're literally like sitting on the floor in this apartment, a beautiful apartment, but
I would love to know what your parents were talking to each other about when they were thinking about where you guys were up to.
People would come over and there was just nowhere to sit. You know, there was like our beds were on the floor upstairs, which, you know, my wife did put money into like organic, like cotton mattresses. Okay. So, but they were just on the floor upstairs. And, you know, we always sleep as a family anyway. So we just have a bunch of them pushed together and we all just kind of crash out like a lion's anyways. And so we're like, well, we got to pull the trigger on this, buying this house, or we lose our money, our earnest money. And the phone rang and it was, my sister. And she said, you know, she's up in Montana and she says, hey, Dad's been in an accident and they just flew him from Montana to Washington State because it's so bad that they can't even treat him here. So we were like, okay, we're leaving. We called our realtor and said, we're not buying the house. We're going to Seattle. So we basically packed up. We were on our way to Seattle within a couple of days, or within a day. And we ended up spending a few months up there just living in Airbnbs while we were like spending time with him, with my father. And he had like a broken hip and anyway, he was unconscious in the intensive care.
Wow.
For, I don't remember, like 2 months. And that basically after a certain amount of time, they were like, hey, you know, we have to make a decision because he's not getting any better.
Oh, no.
And so we were like, oh, okay. But this is a whole nother story. He ended up making it.
Really? Good on him.
Good on him. And he is still doing very well. And he's living by himself up in Montana again in his home. And he's doing fantastic. But everyone was sure he was going to die then. And while we were up there, you know, it was sort of had become a habit for me just to search through Zillow, which is like a real estate search app.
Yeah. I've had that addiction myself.
Yeah. And we found this house on the Big Island of Hawaii. And we were like, this is crazy. 4 acres, completely off-grid home. Completely. So it's all solar and catchment for water.
Red.
And we're like, let's go check it out. And so Dad, we left him to go out there. And I immediately fell in love with it. I was like, this just feels good.
Now, and just for folks that haven't sort of learned a lot about Hawaii, a lot of us think of it as like the big beach with the big buildings and almost like you're in Malibu or Miami mm-hmm. or something. But apparently, and friends tell me this from New Zealand particularly, when you get away from the main strip of Waikiki, I think it's called, right? Then it actually becomes quite a rural, tropical place. Is that right?
Well, yeah. So there's the main island, which is Oahu. That's like, that's where the big airport in Honolulu is. That's where Waikiki is. Big hotels, manicured, and easy to get around. You know, you can drive around the whole island, and basically every beach you can stop at is someone's been there and made sure it's, I don't know, it's for tourists.
Right.
You take a small flight over to Hawaii, the big island of the chain of Hawaiian islands, and it's a whole different story. There's Kona, which is still sort of a tourist area. But if you go to the east side of the big island, it just turns into jungle. We bought this house in a town called Pahoa, which is in the area of Puna, which is the southeast, whole southeast corner of the island. And it is just, it's beautiful. It's raw and rugged. In front of our home, there was like these 20, 30 foot lava cliffs. And just all day, the waves would come and just pound against the cliffs and water would be spraying up in the air. And whales would come out of the water less than 100 yards off the coast there. So we would stand across from our house and whales were full breach out there, less than like 70 yards out, because there's this huge channel that runs really deep right there. Because, you know.
And it's humpbacks that travel through there, is that right?
It's humpback whales, yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, so now people are thinking, these guys escaped suburbia. They had the family health scare. Dad pulled through. They've moved to paradise. Why did you leave there and come to Cambodia? Was that the next step?
So at that point, you know, if you're sticking with me, which it sounds like you are, we're like, okay, society's not for us.
Yeah.
We got this little boost of money, which, you know, thank God for that.
Yeah.
It allowed us to sort of leave the atmosphere. And now we're sort of coasting and we're like, okay, we have enough money to sort of make some decisions or have some freedom. We used all that money getting to Hawaii, buying that home, and trying to set up a retreat center in this home, because it was a 7-bedroom home. Not a beautiful home by any means, but it was there. The property was just beautiful. I mean, I would spend all my time just walking around back behind our house. There's these magnificently huge, monstrous monkey pod trees, you know, were just, they're like, if you could put a treehouse somewhere, it's in one of these, you know? And so we loved it so much that we literally, after the first month or so of being in the house, we pitched a tent across the street. It's like a road, a rural road, on the cliffs of the ocean, maybe set back about 30, 50 feet. And we spent every night in that tent. We would just leave the house and go and like sleep in the tent at night. We'd have our books and, you know, our little beds in there and stuff. And we would read to Nala. And then in the next morning, we'd wake up and kind of go over to the house and, you know, cook breakfast and everything. But every evening, about 5 or 6 o'clock, we would just go to the tent. And that's where we'd be. So at this point, we're thinking, okay, society, that's for losers. We're making a real change, you know, we're going to do something different. And we're trying to get this retreat center set up, which, long story short, never worked out. We did end up turning it into an Airbnb, just the top floor, which worked out really nice. We lived downstairs, okay. But we also decided at this point that the most important thing that we could have is friends and family living with us. Because we're like, what are we missing? You know, light bulb. It's community. So we moved in my wife's mother, my mother-in-law, I'm a brave man. We brought her brother over. She has a younger brother.
I love the way that your first thought wasn't, we'll go back to the States. Right. Your first thought was, let's bring the people that we care about to paradise in the middle of the South Pacific Ocean.
Yeah. And then, and then some friends of ours from San Diego came over with their son, who was just a year and a half, 2 years older than Nala. Xander is his name. So then all these people came in and started living in the downstairs of the home. On 4.5 acres. The upstairs we're running as an Airbnb because we are now completely out of money. Zero.
And just for folks, I mean, we do a bit of Airbnb ourselves and it's amazing. And my folks have a bed and breakfast in Auckland, bush, sand and sea. It's a good way to supplement your lifestyle, isn't it?
Yeah.
Not to get rich.
No.
But to keep the engines running.
Right.
Right.
Absolutely. I mean, it was the only thing that allowed us to pay our mortgage.
Right.
So there was this sort of like end where, you know, we're not making any money, but we're getting the Airbnb going and we have, you know, it's $60,000 left and 50. And we're like, well, that's still good. That's more than, you know, a lot of people have by far, 40, 30, 20. And I'm like, and there's no sign of income coming in. And I had this just complete overwhelming fear sort of took over of watching, you know, my savings just go down to zero. And I was like, I'm going to lose my mind. And we hit zero and then went below zero. We didn't borrow money from anybody, but there was, you know, nothing like left. And the Airbnb's going, so we're managing to pay the rent, but you know, if we want to go somewhere and buy a sandwich, we're like, okay, do we have $5 to spend on that? Or should we just... But what happened to us was like, or at least to me, was a pretty profound change. I thought that was the end. I mean, that was my fear was, you know, as I watched the money, once we hit zero, that was over. But we still had the house. I mean, we still had a place to live. But, and then I realized that, you know what? I didn't die. You know, we still were like able to do things and we got the Airbnb going enough that we could survive. And so that fear sort of like, it was a real learning lesson. I mean, it was personally.
Sure.
Just to, and then the fear was gone because then at that point, I'm like, there's nothing else to lose. So now I can actually do something. You know, the fear's gone. So I'm like, all right, we'll work on this Airbnb and we'll work on the property and it worked, you know, and so we lived that way for about a year and a half, two and a half years, I should say. And then the lava came, Kilauea, you know, erupted. There was a big earthquake and everybody left and the lava came pouring down, you know, the volcano towards us and we had to leave because it... Basically, it cut off one of our ways. There was only two ways out of that corner of the island. It flowed over one, and there was still one open, but it had cracks in the road.
Oh, my God.
So we were like, now what? You know? And everyone, my mother-in-law, my brother-in-law, and our friends from San Diego immediately left. And we stayed for a few more weeks, as long as we could, even though, you know, people kind of thought we were crazy to stay there, but... A lot of people in that area are like that.
Yeah.
You know, once you live in that sort of rural, eastern, big island, Hawaii, you're like, you get this connection with the land and you sort of kind of toss things up to fate.
This is where I belong.
Yeah. Or wherever you're at. And you're just like, you know what? There's a bigger force at work here. And whether I'm afraid or whether I run or whether I stay isn't as important as whatever my sort of fate and destiny is. So we stayed as long as we could.
I've heard a similar story from a lot of folks in Australia during the bushfires and Black Saturday in Melbourne.
Yeah.
Do we leave? Do we stay?
Yeah. And there's just sort of this like turning it over to like a higher power and just saying, well, we'll just see, right? I'm not in charge, obviously. So we ended up leaving and... I took a job again because we were like, well, we need some funds.
Yeah.
And we have nowhere really to go. And I took a job in D.C.
Back in the States, yeah.
Yeah, back in the States. And that's where I was introduced to the water kefir. Back to that.
Of all places.
Yeah. And, you know, that lasted about 6 months. And thank God for them because it was a really nice paying job. And they moved us out there. And, you know, they kind of got us back on our feet. And so...
What a job interview that would have been. So tell us about why you're looking for work. Well, my house is almost covered in lava in Hawaii.
Right? I had a different pitch. I was like, okay, how am I going to sell this? You know, and I didn't lie, of course. I did tell them what was happening, but it was sort of like, you know, here's why I have to re-enter society right now because, you know, our house is being threatened by lava. And so I took the job. It turns out I had changed a lot more than I thought. That job lasted about 6 months, at which point they sat me down and said, you know, we just don't see the fire in you that we need, you know, that we want. We want someone who's like fired up. And so we had a very different sort of idea of what I was going to do there for them, for this job, which I saw more of a like, you know, I saw myself doing things very differently than they saw me doing them. They wanted me to come in and really be sort of like day to day, you know, like cold calling and doing that sort
of thing, hunting,
like hunter.
Yeah.
You better be like...
Doesn't reading go with strolling through the monkey
tree? Nope. And I had been out too long for that kind of thing. And I told them, you know, when they sat me down, I was like, well, that's really not what you were getting with me.
Yeah.
So anyways, that ended abruptly after 6 months in Maryland. And then we took basically what we had saved up in money and sort of took a 2-month road trip from the east coast of the U.S., D.C., across to California and Montana to see family again. And we just winded our way across.
Had the U.S. changed in that time? Because, I mean, it's been quite a journey in the U.S. in the last, say, 5 to 10 years, right? Economically, socially, politically, right? Did you feel like things had changed in that time that you'd been out, just as an aside?
You know, when we were leaving the Big Island to go to D.C., we were pretty sure that we were going to hate it.
Right.
We were like, you know, because I can't think of more extreme opposites in the States. And, you know, we loved it. We really loved it. We met some really fantastic people in Maryland that sort of re-energized and gave us new faith in society, in people that we had lost, you know, 5 years or, you know, 4 years earlier when we decided to get out. And we're like, okay, you know, it's not so much whether you're in D.C. or you're on the east coast of Hawaii. You can make it, you know, your own personal, you know, heaven or hell, no matter where you are. And, you know, the things for us, Hawaii really didn't work out. Just, I wanted to, I guess, get back to that real quick. All the family living in one house. I'm not recommending that to anybody. I mean, hats off to anyone who can make that work. We did not. It really did not end or, you know, proceed the way that we had hoped.
Right.
A lot of...
Have your family close, but maybe in different houses, yeah?
Different houses, yeah.
Okay.
So we were happy to try again with what we've learned from that experience. Everyone gets their own apartment. And so we've actually thought about that in Cambodia, which is, okay, everyone, you can come back if you want to try again, but everyone gets their own apartment. And, you know, we'll see each other on the weekends and we'll have, you know, our own time, or we don't want to see you. Don't come over. You know, but no one's taken us up on that offer yet.
Fair enough. And then perhaps I learned from the process as well. I can see Hannah outside, and I know that probably shortly we need to go and catch a plane to Vietnam.
Okay, of course.
But I really want to get to how you got to Cambodia.
So okay,
finish that road trip.
So the road trip, we decided at that point to finish the road trip with a trip to Vietnam, 1 month, just to get our heads straight and figure out what our next move is going to be. because we had a little chunk of change coming out of DC again. We're like, what are we going to do with this? So Jade's first, you know, thing is vacation, which is always her. I'm always like, oh, we got to invest. We got to save. You know, we got to like make real plans. She's like, vacation. We get our mind straight. So we went to Vietnam for a month, Phu Quoc. And while we were there,
the island off the south coast.
Yeah, a little island, yeah.
Yeah.
And so while we were there, we actually met this guy named Joe who was brewing kombucha over there. He only had like in one restaurant, but it was delicious. And I had some gastrointestinal, some GI stuff going on, and I didn't know how to fix it. We found that kombucha and I drank it, and I was like instantly, like you could almost feel it in that moment. Like I felt better. And I was like, okay, we're going to start our company, Kombucha Kefir, you know, here in Phu Quoc. And we didn't. We ended up leaving there, and we said, where should we go while we're in Southeast? This was supposed to be a one-month vacation. Yeah, and then right. Back to Seattle.
Technically, you hit.
My truck is in airport parking. We missed our flight home on purpose and came here to Siem Reap because we needed to renew our visas anyways. So we just left Vietnam, mm-hmm. Came here. We were going to go back over there. But once we got here, we were like, this is awesome. We
love just Siem Reap. Do you want to briefly just describe Siem Reap? Because I hadn't heard of the place until I knew we were going to come here to see Angkor Wat.
The only reason we came here is because I'd seen a picture of Angkor Wat. There was a picture where the roots of the tree were growing over the ruins of the ancient temples.
The Tomb Raider shot.
And I don't... Yeah, I guess so. Something like that. I don't think it had any movie references in the picture I was thinking of.
Right, right.
But I was like, there is something about that is so intriguing to me. So we came here and then we were going to go back to Vietnam and start that company. We'd already kind of prepped things a little bit there, looking for real estate and anyways, or a place to do it. And we came here and we were like, this is pretty sweet. You know, I don't know what it is specifically other than, you know, there's something about the Cambodians that we've interacted with so far. And we've been here 6 months now. They're like poor, but you know, they don't have the means that we have, or you know, most Western, you know, people would have, Western cultures. But by any means, I mean, you know, I think, well, I was just talking to one of our staff yesterday. He said, if you go through school, go to college, and come out of college, you can expect to get a job around here paying maybe $200 a month. Which is, you know, obviously nothing, but they are still like, they're not, you know, they're not broken by that by any means. To them, it's a different idea about money for the most part. They're not striving for it.
And a different idea about community, right?
Absolutely. And that's something that we're learning out here, which is if you have community, if you have friends and, you know, your family around, you don't need money. You know, you don't need a big bank account to get by because you have people, you know, and people are going to be there for you. And that's reflected everywhere in Siem Reap. And that's what we love about it. You know, the people are very resilient. They're very full, even though they're poor.
They're the smiles, right? Those open, friendly, genuine, welcoming smiles.
Mm-hmm.
Coming from a really intelligent, measured place.
Yeah.
You know? Okay, so why give kefir? Let's finish on that note.
Sure.
And then give folks a way to contact you and share that last piece.
We had gotten, you know, we were here for a couple of weeks and, you know, Jade and I, we're, you know, in our free time when the baby's asleep and Nala's doing something. Baby number two, yeah.
Yeah, the second adventure.
Born in Maryland, actually, at home. Okay. Both of our children were home births. We were just sitting there thinking of ideas and sort of reflecting on the things that we had learned, you know, and one of those things was brewing kombucha and brewing kefir. So we thought we loved doing that. Actually, when we had our whole United States road trip for 2 months, I had a glass jar full of kefir grains, and the whole way we were brewing, we would stop and get a jug of water or get some, you know, sugar and feed them. We'd go into the hotels with a big jug, you know, and they're looking at us like, what is that?
Moonshine?
Yeah, we're like, what are you guys doing? And we were always making it because we loved it that much. We would just carry it in the backseat of the truck. And so anyways, we thought, well, that's really nice. And that seems like something that could really benefit the people, especially the children in Siem Reap, because we know how it benefited us. And it doesn't seem like the people around, you know, in Siem Reap have access to like a rich probiotic sort of, you know, beverage or food even. So our idea was to make it and give it away and just make as much as we can and give it away. And then if a business came out of that, great. But that if we did it with the intention of just giving it away, that the rest we thought would just sort of like, you know, fill in. And so that's what we started doing in our house at home. We just started brewing. We bought these, we brought the supplies, and we just started making it and refining our recipes and our process of making it. And then every few days we would just give it away. Even if someone came by the house, you know, we'd be like, hey, come in here. We pour them a bunch. Like, take a bottle, you know.
So, what was the kind of reception you were getting from folks?
Mixed. Some people were afraid of it.
They'd never seen this idea before.
No, they hadn't. And so we would, you know, we started trying to, we got some material printed because most of them just didn't even know what it was. They're like, what's
there's this strange weird big job, guy giving me?
Yeah. White people living in scenery, giving us weird stuff in bottles. Like, they just, you know, they don't know what to do.
Seems a bit weird.
Yeah, you know, so we were like, we'll go over to the school, but then that seemed weird to give it to the kids. And the monks, we wanted to give it to monks, and they loved it. And so we've been doing some of that as much as we can. And so anyways, that was the whole idea, is just to give it away. And that's why we named it Give Kefir, because that was the whole idea, was to give the kefir. The kefir doesn't have any caffeine in it, so we thought it would be the best for kids.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's so much like dengue and just sort of I don't know if it's malnutrition, but
challenges. Yeah.
In that vein, that we thought for sure, you know, kefir will definitely benefit this community. So, and we wanted to do that in a non-caffeinated way for the kids. So that's why the kefir. And we've just been giving it away. And if we get too much, we just give it away. And like I said, we just hope that the business comes around at least to make it sustainable. We don't expect this to, you know, make us rich or, you know, buy us anything other than the opportunity to have it. Yeah. Have it in Siem Reap. Have a staff. And be able to like provide it to the community. That's really what we want out of it.
I think that's awesome. And as a Westerner that was visiting Siem Reap, we're walking down the street, and one of the first things I said to Hannah was, oh, we're going to Cambodia, that'll be awesome. But what do they do for their probiotics? Like, will I be able to get kefir? I know I can get it in Eastern Europe, I can get it in the Mediterranean, I can get it in places like Istanbul and Turkey. But what, I guess I'll just take a little probiotic pill with me. It's not the best. It's kind of Russian roulette in terms of, will this bacteria take in my stomach? Mm-hmm. I really want kefir or kombucha. We're walking down the street and I see this sign that says, give kefir. It's name and I. And so it's just lit up and it was almost like a shaft of light from God. I'm just like, no way. There's kefir here. Then it said, come in and have some free. Try it. Tell us what you think. And I was like, this could really work because as tourists coming in, a lot of us are left-thinking, open-minded, traveling, wandering souls, right? Mm-hmm. And we probably shop at the same types of whole food shops that you guys used to shop at in Maryland, right?
Right.
So I can really see, like, and I know you're wanting to get into cafes and restaurants, and I can see me going up to the counter in a restaurant and saying, I won't have a Coca-Cola, I'll have a give kombucha.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so much better. I mean, it just tastes better. It is better. People drink it for the first time or the 100th time, 1,000th time. You just feel it, you know. It is like an energizing from like within sort of like, you know, thing to put in your body. Awesome. So we love it. You know, we really enjoy what we're doing here.
I think it's magic. And good things have to come from it, right? So how can folks find out more about Give Kefir and your your plans?
Probably the easiest way is to go to facebook.com/givekiefer, K-E-F-I-R. And, you know, there's contact information on there. We are by no means marketing people. So, you know, don't expect a lot, but there is contact. There's a way to message us. There's a way to leave a post or a note or something for us, and we'd be happy to get back to people.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing your story. That is amazing. And thanks. I wish you guys all the best with what you're doing. And for anybody listening, kefir and kombucha, particularly the water kefir, is going to be a really easy thing for you to just have when you're at a cafe on the weekend, because it reminds me a lot of an organic ginger beer, or even like a lime and soda pop or something like that. And I invite you to have a look at it and maybe get some grains and make a bit at home, see if your kids are into it. There's a real science experiment feel to it, kind of like making your own bread.
Yeah.
And I just love to see more of this in the world. So.
Great.
Thank you for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And thank you for tuning in, folks. And thank you for subscribing. I look forward to the next adventure and the next story when it comes along.